So the title of today's talk is Zen and the Sandwich of Family Caregiving. I'll explain what all that means, though I'm sure you can intuit it. It definitely describes my current status to a T. Well, at least I hope the Zen part does too, but it's also most likely something many of you have experienced or anticipate experiencing. And I'll provide a little bit of like a sociological context in a moment for that term, the sandwich years. But as it applies to this moment, before I really start here, I'm still very much providing care for my college-aged kids. You know, they continue to need my guidance, even if they're not under my roof. And also at the same time, I'm beginning to contemplate my empty nest in a way that's sort of more fraught than I had expected originally, but it's mostly pride and joy, but there's melancholy there too, for sure. But at the same time, the timing is really, it's uncanny because just as my younger son was graduating from high school, it started to become clear that my parents somewhat suddenly and then increasingly need my help more and more. My mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in June. So that was, I think, just a few days before my younger son's graduation. So it's, you know, it's a significant time in many ways. And my mom is still in the very early stages of the disease. But the diagnosis itself felt very heavy. And I would say, you know, especially for her, she's a nurse, psychiatric nurse. She's well aware of what it all means. So in terms of that Zen part, you know, if I can get enough distance from the situation, you know, psychological, emotional distance, I can see very clearly that this is a Dharma gate. And it's one that I wasn't quite ready to enter. I didn't, you know, see it coming, really. There were signs, but I didn't really see it coming like this. And so the purpose of this talk is really this, and I'll very much look forward to all of your thoughts too, and experiences, but how can I view this moment in time as a practice opportunity? How do I bring a mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, right effort, you know, grounded not only in my love for my family, deep love, but also motivated by compassion for all beings? And most centrally, I think of this as sort of a central koan to me, maybe one of many, but how can I grow in compassion has really been on my mind for a couple of years, it's really especially. So I think all of that kind of marks this, the significance of this moment. And I have come to feel that I don't always have the, you know, the right stuff when it comes to compassion, but I'll return to that in a sec. So you might be familiar with the term the sandwich years or the sandwich generation. Just a show of hands, who knows, who has seen or heard that term, sandwich years? Okay, most of us, yeah. So there have been a number of things written in the past bunch of years about it because we're entering a new era where it's sort of more common because of demographics and so forth. It refers to the period, usually in middle age, when adults are both caring for their kids' needs while also tending to the growing health concerns of their aging parents. So it's not a fixed generation based on your year of birth, like being a baby boomer or Generation X. It's a moment in time we all face pretty much, no matter what sociological generation we are part of. And this phenomenon was recognized in the late 20th century as changes in lifespan. And a later age for childbearing meant that moms often had smaller kids and frail parents at the same time. So for example, in the early 20th century, a woman might have had her first child at around age 20. and her own parents were maybe 40. So that's not really typical anymore. Your parents then were not necessarily in need of special care. But more recently, in developed countries anyway, women often have children later. I didn't have my sons until my mid-30s. My mom had me in her mid-20s. So there's, you know, there's that collapsing of time makes it more likely that you'll reach this stage where both the kids, if they exist in your life, will need you at the same time as your parents. And the sandwiched people, you know, become responsible for caring for their parents and their kids at the same time, which may or may not depend, you know, depending on the distance you have, I mean, proximity, physical proximity, you might be called on to help with daily functioning and medical appointments and some supervision, medications, helping with some logistics and financial complications. So I think I saw that the number is that one in eight of Americans currently, age 40 to 70, is both considers themselves still raising a child and also caring for a parent. And that number, the number of older Americans will double by the year 2030 to over 70 million. So that's going to make this more of a likely scenario for more people. But anyway, so there's, that's the definition part. But coming back to my own story or my take on this, and I'm not going to take you all the way back to my own childhood. You know, it's not worth doing other than to say that my parents have always been extremely loving and attentive to me and my younger sister. And in that, I'm extremely fortunate. Everyone has a different take on their own childhood, but mine wasn't, you know, all golden and glowing, but in terms of what my parents provided, it was very stable. All right, so but just to go back to last year, to start there really, or maybe a year and a half ago, early in 2022, before my mom's diagnosis, although we did have some concerns about her, we were noticing some things. I was, you know, both my boys were still home, and I was anticipating that sort of existential shift that I've heard my friends talk about as they prepare for their empty nest years. I'm a birder also, so that whole nest factor really does resonate for me. But for the most part, you know, I was looking forward to it. I think people do, a lot. I mean, it's a next phase. You're envisioning a new freedom. And, you know, while I was well aware that I would continue to experience plenty of mothering moments, even when my boys were no longer under my roof, I also hoped that, you know, seeing them kind of fledge, more birding, would bring a sense of peace. And I was also at the same time trying to prepare them for their adult lives in both practical and also like philosophical matters, just getting them ready. And also they were preparing me by becoming more independent, driving and, you know, wanting to spend more time with friends than at home. So my partner, Kevin, and I had planned more road trips for the future. You know, we have a little van. I had hoped to travel more, to sit in the dirt sangha with all of you, maybe a couple of times a year, perhaps more, continue to run my business and so forth. But, you know, as long as the one thing that was on my mind is remaining free of a breast cancer recurrence, that was sort of it's a punctuation for me in my life. So as long as that stays clear and my family was healthy and happy, there was sort of this, you know, bright light that was, you know, beginning to shine through. You know, I've said before in a different talk that I have struggled with depression and anxiety most of my life. But, you know, my Zazen practice and Dharma study and all of you, Sangha, felt really central to my well-being and ability to kind of help others. And I guess an expanding of the ability to view troubling aspects of time, the concept of time, with gratitude instead of dread and like clock watching and obsessing. At the time last year, I was also enrolling in a course at New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. I was eager to begin, and I was at the time even considering maybe a career shift or at least volunteer opportunities, and that went a different way than I expected. So that kind of is also part of this whole time, you know, when I consider those plans, I can see now that they were just a little bit delusional. Maybe more than a little bit delusional. I'm not getting in a van and traveling away, and I'm not. I mean, I'm gonna, you know, I want to stay here in my community. I want to be closer to my family, no matter where they are. My son, one son will be in New York. One son is still local, or really very local. And that's good. And I started to feel like I want to be here physically for them more. Not neurotically, but, you know, just be present. When I think about like what I was planning versus what is today, it feels a little self-centered. I have to, you know, admit, I feel like I was being selfish. I understand that that's, you know, sort of like moms feel like they earn the, you know, after 18, 19, however many years of being an active parent, you know, with kids under your roof, you are kind of looking for a new stage. And I don't begrudge any of us who look for that kind of light at the end of that tunnel, but it's also a little bit excruciating. I will say it's like glorious and excruciating. And I kind of, you know, think about it also like parenting with each day, like you could bounce between it being absolutely wonderful and horrible within the course of an hour or two. And you know, that's just the way it goes when you've got kids. But so as hindsight is a 2020 path to the present moment, and I'm trying to be, you know, mindfully acknowledge this time, here's how I see the past year or so as most significant. I became aware that I needed to grow steadily in compassion. A couple of, I don't know, felt like the universe was delivering me some messages, that I needed to feel more for the universe, for all sentient beings, the love that I feel for my family. I wanted to learn from that love. So this is still very much in process. It's not simple, not at all. But, you know, to give you a little bit more insight into me, you know, I'm a solitary person in general. You know, some of us took the Enneagram test, and I'm a solid 5. I am a 5, which is like a solitary person who tends to over-intellectualize and seek knowledge. Rather than maybe more deeply feel things, it's possible we push emotions away. You know, I'm bookish by trade. For those of you who don't know, I've always been in the book industry. I own a bookstore, but also my whole life I've been that way. And, you know, I need boundaries in my life. I need solitude, probably more than most people. That's how I energize. That's how I find my way back to being able to function out in the world. I own a retail business. So it's like, I mean, yes, it's books and it is my little baby, that store, but you know, it's a little bit exhausting. I've become more and more aware of that. However, my kids really have had my whole heart. Like when it comes to, you know, I can over-intellectualize things all I want, but there's nothing like my kids to kind of break that. So they've been sort of the exception to my head centeredness that I've always had. But, you know, I've had some real deep lingering concerns that would rear their head frequently, especially in the past couple of years. And I don't think that this is a coincidence, about my own kind of karmic baggage. especially as it pertains to some unskillful decisions and actions in the past, especially in relationships. And so, you know, though we're told not to dwell on past mistakes, I think that's the precept I have the hardest time with in a certain way. It really has been on my mind. How have I hurt my family during the period of time that I made these mistakes? As I continue to feel like they keep coming back up, did I hurt them? The short answer is yes. And, you know, I felt like reparations were necessary, and like, we're still in talks about that. I'm still in talks with myself about it. And furthermore, my confidence was compromised, I would say, when I found it very difficult to connect after I started in the contemplative care course at New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. I found it very difficult to connect to the content and to my cohorts there. In the way that I was perceiving all of them doing, when I'm looking at their faces and, you know, expressions and their immersion in it, I could see, I couldn't find that in my own self. And I really felt lacking. I felt lesser than there. It almost felt like a character deficit. What is wrong with me that I am not feeling this way? They were all just more deeply drawn in than I was. And I was very concerned. So, you know, I will tell you, I withdrew from the course. And I struggled with that for a little while. It really did feel like a failure before I came to terms with it being okay. It clarified a few things. It clarified that I needed to focus on my bookstore business and my family, but that the fact that I was interested in growing in compassion was going to serve me, maybe not in a professional way. You know, I wasn't going to become an end of life caregiver, like a hospice caregiver, but, you know, though I would still certainly be interested in volunteering. But, you know, maybe it was going to help in other ways. So that sort of became clear. So while it did feel like a failure in a certain way, it also kind of was a window opening. And then last summer, a very powerful glimpse of clarity came to me, was delivered in the form of a passage in Susan Moon's book, Alive Until You're Dead. And this, I mean, I think more than, it's hard to even remember something that I've read being as affecting as this was to me. So I'm just going to read this passage to you, page 57. So Zen Master Dogen in 13th century Japan had a young student named Tetsu. You might be familiar with this story too, but who was a very serious practitioner with excellent zazen practice and perfect comportment. He recited the sutras fluently and did everything he was asked to do, but he was short on compassion. Before Dogen died, he told Tetsu, "You can understand all of Buddhism, but you cannot go beyond your abilities and your intelligence unless you have Robaishin, grandmother mind, the mind of great compassion." Dogen's phrase Robaishin has been translated variously as grandmother mind, parental mind, kind mind, and compassionate mind. In his instructions for the Zen cook, Dogen says that monks should have the spirit of parents or grandparents who, without regard for whether they themselves are cold or hot, shade or cover the child. As for Tetsu, he later became abbot at Eiji Dogen's temple. And I like to think this was possible because he cultivated grandmother mind. Okay, so I read that and was like, wow, that really felt perfectly timed to me. That's what I need. I need grandmother mind. That's what I need to cultivate. And like, especially, you know, in a literal sense, I take parenting, seriously. And I'm also still learning from my parents who are the, you know, really wonderful grandparents to my kids and my niece. So Robaishin, that term, you know, I had to admit, I didn't remember learning that term. But boy, it did seem like an answer to me that I had been seeking. And really, I saw it and continue to see it as a bridge to universal compassion, that thing that I felt like I was lacking. It felt like an invitation. So this is where my mom's diagnosis and my own kind of existential reckoning of my son's growing up comes in. My mom's behavior last year especially had seemed to change, and it was particularly noticeable to my dad and my sister and to me. She was suddenly kind of airing a lot of grievances with all of us and with everyone that we never knew she had. She was showing a lot of anger, in particular toward my dad, which she had never done. She often seemed like a hyperactive kid that needed to be redirected a lot, but you couldn't redirect her. Like a 2-year-old who just wants what they want. And it was noticeable. She's always been kind of charmingly wacky, lovable, colorful, but this was new. And then we started to notice the short-term memory gaps, some physical changes, like she's got a tic in her face now that causes her to do some tongue protrusions. She's walking a little funny, or like slanty walking. And also, most of all, I mean, she has this sort of meta reaction. As I said, she's a nurse, a psychiatric nurse. And so she's seen a lot and learned a lot. So having to think about her own mind deteriorating was really causing her great distress. She has always called herself a lifelong learner. She's taken a million, adult courses. She loves to read. She has so much FOMO about missing like cultural events or any talk locally or online. If she feels like she's going to miss it, it causes her great distress. And so, for someone like that to be aware of the deterioration of their own cognition is probably, it's probably something that causes even more distress. So, I felt that it was time for me to really step up with her diagnosis. But by the way, she underwent a battery of tests several times. There is kind of like, I guess, a standard inventory of what they do. My mom is very University of Pennsylvania centric, I should say. She's like a proud graduate of the nursing school, and everything she thinks and does has to do with Penn. Not everything, but she loves it there. So we went to Penn's memory center, and she did have this battery of tests, which she failed. Some of these typical things like repeating words and so forth. I don't know that she ever would have been good with that, because she's always had a little bit of like expressive language delays. I don't know. I wouldn't have necessarily said that before, but I think it is true. But she didn't do well on her tests. And so when I accompanied her and I was the only one, by the way, she wanted me to accompany her. She didn't want my dad to come, because she was having this anger with him, which we were still trying to get to the bottom of. So I accompanied her to the exam, and the doctor interviewed me about the changes that I had been seeing in her and how it was kind of manifesting. And I said that I felt that it was manifesting in personality changes more than memory that I could see, although she was having some gaps in short-term memory. You might have this experience, someone who's having some cognitive issues, they're like, you might not see it if you talk to them for 5 minutes or even 10, but maybe they're on that like 15 minute loop. And then you start to kind of like see it more after you've been talking to them for a while. So that period of time has been like shrinking a little bit. I see that happening. So I'll be on the phone with her, by the way. She calls me 4 or 5 times a day. We need some more boundaries. But not just call, FaceTime. She FaceTimes me 4 or 5 times a day. And she loves FaceTime. So we'll be talking. And then by the end of the conversation, we're having the same conversation. We're telling the same story. So also she, something that I have always like struggled with her is like she loves gossip. And I don't like that. So I even, I'll tolerate some of it as long as it's not, mean-spirited, really, but because of her personality changes, it had become a little bit more mean-spirited. Like, she was taking pleasure in other people's, difficulties. And so that was strange. And then also she would say the same things. Like, we would, when I would drive her somewhere, and she was still driving. She still drives a tiny bit. We allow it in our neighborhood, but she would be driving, and she would, every single time I would drive past one house, she would say the exact same thing. How much she hated the house, how ugly it was. These things like didn't exist for her before. So, all of these things were noticeable. She was still going about her daily routine. My mother gets ice cream every single day. This is very important to her. She has insisted that when she, at her funeral, that we serve ice cream. And we will. Hopefully it's not for a long time. But yeah, so she's, she's still very into her routine and still talking on the phone to her friends and so forth. But these, if you've had an experience with Alzheimer's, and we're still at very early stages, it rolls like this, and it's hard not to anticipate the future. I think for her, especially because she's in it. She's, since her diagnosis, her mood has lifted a little bit, and we're seeing some of the anger. I think a lot of the anger came as a result of confusion, like her own, not quite processing the cognitive changes that she was having, like kind of knowing they were there, but not quite acknowledging it, being in a little bit of denial. And so like taking out her frustration on us, on a couple of her friends. Like, she kept saying, like, she's on my shit list. And like, she never would have said that before. What do you mean? So her shit list was getting very long all of a sudden. I was like, this is a symptom in and of itself. So, through all of this, the thing that has become clear, to me, very clear, is that this is the moment in time when I need to show up. I need to demonstrate right effort here when it comes to caring for my mom and also helping my dad through it. Because he's like, he's a little befuddled by it all. And he, my parents have, an unusual marriage, I would say. My dad spends half the year in Florida. My mom does not. And it's always been that way, or it's been that way for a number of years. I think that's why they're still married, actually, because they get that distance from each other. It seems necessary. And I get it. But he was away last winter. And when he came back, and I had been, stepping in and doing some things, he noticed a big change. So I don't know that he'll be able to go for the whole winter this year. And that's weighing on him, because he really does love that getaway. But I want to be able to help him also. My parents still live in their house. It's not the house where I grew up. It's the house they moved to after I graduated from high school. It's livable for them, absolutely. But we're just trying to get her to understand that she might need to make some plans for different type of housing, supportive housing. Anyway, with all of that said, the main point of all of this, and that I see as a significant moment, is like, this is the opportunity to be more centered in compassion, to use this feeling that I have, this place that I've arrived, where I am arriving at every day and every moment, and turn it outward. Use it to not only care for my parents and my kids and my family and my cats, but to also kind of find some energy to make good, really. So how do you do that? I mean, it's not that simple, right? We have lives and we have things to do. And I still, as I said, because we're in early days, I have no idea how much I'll be called on to do in terms of daily caregiving as things progress. I'm not really anticipating that too much. I'm actively trying to stay here and not anticipate it too much, because I know of the horrors of Alzheimer's. But, you know, I have started to kind of put into place some things that I feel are useful to me in contending with the situation and with her as she changes, while also staying committed to helping. So some of those strategies include not just, you know, Zazen, which I do almost every day, but also adding meditation more to my practice. And there's, you know, we have this Saturday group, some of you are here, which has become very important, learning more about metta meditation, which I had actually done before Zazen, you know, years ago. But it, at this point, it is that loving kindness and compassion that's cultivated is really important for me to kind of carry around as a message for myself as a caregiver, and then also for my family and for everyone else. So when you repeat metta messages during a meditation, you know, you are starting with you and then them and then everyone. And that's incredibly useful. There's also the practice of Tonglen, which is like breathing in someone's suffering, breathing out relief for them. It's not a practice that I'm trained in or skilled in. It's only something I've read about and studied a little bit, but it's been useful. I'm, you know, in other words, my mother's not a Buddhist. My parents aren't Buddhists. They're not religious really at all. And they're secular Jews. They're not religious, but she's open to things. So I have actually said out loud, you know, this is what, you know, I would love to be able to sit with you. The idea of meditation to her is very, very foreign. She's never done it. So, you know, I'd like to be able to help ease her anxiety by introducing some of that, but mostly at this moment it's me doing it so that I can care for her. Also, you know, the type of breathing and mindfulness techniques that I've engaged in for a very long time have always served as like resets during my day to kind of like, when I say I need solitude, a lot of it is just me sitting there. I might look like I'm kind of staring into space. But that's what I'm doing. I'm just kind of like re-energizing breathing. And then like a really important part of this is how it affects me, how it affects us. And like, I'm anticipating the caregiver, that kind of syndrome where, you know, it really being a caregiver seems to really deeply affect people, even on a somatic level, you know, you start getting symptoms of things. It's hard, it's stressful. And so there's, you know, no way to prevent what your reaction, you can't really, you know, that you're going to be deeply affected by it, right? But is there a way to transform kind of the dread of that into gratitude for what is and what has been? So that's just something I'm thinking about, how to kind of connect that with some breathing exercises too. Yeah, it's, you know, as I said, it's of course easier said than done. And there's so much that goes into this. And then interestingly, as this period of time, kind of like this full circle of things, my older son, Julian, with whom I've had some struggles for sure over the years, he is actually living at my parents' house upstairs. And it's a good situation. He's going to be 20. They have like a, almost like an apartment upstairs. So he loves it. It's like having an apartment of his own. But he thinks he's there to help my parents and he feels good about it. And my parents think they're there to help him, you know, by giving him a free place to live. It seems to be working out. It's not a forever thing, but it's an interesting kind of like manifestation of this moment too, that I didn't expect to happen. And it's actually very good. So I'm going to open it up to all of you here, but you know, in terms of this period of time, even though this is not what I expected for this period of time, you know, and I thought like, bye, we're just going to sail off or drive off and do a bunch of road trips, and I'll just be sitting in the bookstore the rest of the time and drinking some tea and, you know, calling my kids. It's not that. But I also, in a certain way, wouldn't have it any other way than being a caregiver for my mom. And if my dad needs it, for him too. I would not change that. And, you know, you can ask me again in a few years, but that's how I feel today. Thanks, everybody. Open to comments, questions, the cloud and the dirt. Yeah.
Hi. So many, there was so much in that, Ellen, and it's so, so real, such a portrayal of life. And it was really reminding me of like the 8 worldly winds, and that your life right now is truly being blown about, and you are trying to stay centered within that. There were a few things that came to mind. I was really interested in that word that you said about Robeshian and grandmother mind. And I think that's such a beautiful way to say, stay connected in this situation. And I was thinking about how like the grandmother cares for children and is so wise. And it made me think a little bit about how you were talking about how we can have difficulty forgiving ourselves for past errors in relationships or whatever. And how I was thinking about how there's kind of that teaching that, like maybe a child who committed an error, but then grows and matures, we no longer blame that person anymore because they've grown beyond it. Well, even we as adults, if we committed an error last week or a year ago or 10 years ago, and we've grown beyond that, then that person who committed that error kind of no longer exists. So there's no point being angry at them if we're not going to repeat those errors. And I was thinking grandmother mind would really be a good, nice way to embrace that, because you want to be grandmother mind with yourself as well, like with your children, with your parents, and also with yourself, and just being kind that we will continue to make mistakes and we will continue to try. And there were so many things. And even just how you were talking about boundary setting, that's going to be so important for you. And as your mom, like with the phone calls, I was even thinking, as your mom, she might not always know how long the phone calls are going for. So having like predetermined little boundaries, her feelings hopefully might not get as hurt as much as we might think because of her mental capabilities. Anyway, now I'm just rambling, but it was really beautiful. And I have compassion for you. And you clearly are a person of great compassion, Ellen. And
Thank you.
Heart goes out to your family.
Thank you. When it comes to like the idea of forgiveness or self-forgiveness too, I just want to say in our meta group, actually, Yeshe, I think it was last week or the week before, we were talking about how you can, you know, maybe not forgive the actions of someone, but forgive the person as part of a meta practice. And that really resonated for me in terms of self-forgiveness. So I don't necessarily forgive some of my actions, some of my less wise choices, shall we say, but especially if they hurt anyone. But I am working on forgiving myself. Brian O'Toole.
Thank you. Two things resonated in particular. One was how the experience over time does have this powerful component of grief. You know, love in the face of loss, as someone's capacities change, alter, diminish. You and they experience that loss that provokes grief and then anguish. The other side of that loss, though, is the ability to connect as well as you can. When you see flickerings of the old person, the old reactions, and your reactions confirm for them that they're still connected to you in that way and so forth. So in the same sense that you inevitably have the grief and the anguish, you know, finding those moments and recognizing when you are able to make connection again is, you know, important. And the second thing is, in addition to the boundaries of the complement of it, for in our situation, inevitably one person sort of becomes the primary person, but there's plenty for other people to do and to help and support. And, you know, kind of being really continuously kind of looking at ways where that, you know, the primary person is getting that support and occasionally gets rotated out for someone else on the primary is really was important in our situation. So I think, you know, like all of us, I feel, you know, deeply for this situation. And, you know, I hope we can be, you know, helpful in our small ways.
Thank you, Brian. Mark, I think you were next with your hand up.
It's just a tangent. I just wanted to say, I think it's interesting that you were drawn to Tetsugi Kai's exhortation to cultivate grandmother mind, because he left the abbacy of Eiji. He didn't like die in the office. And he spent 20 years after he left the abbacy of Eiji taking care of his mother. So maybe the grandmother mind only exists in the practice of grandmother mind.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to find the line between being kind of literal about it and also not. Because there's so many kind of concentric circles here with my family and my practice. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I want to read more about that. I didn't remember ever hearing that term. And so thank you. Sarah?
Is it on now?
Okay. Yep.
Lynn, I'm sorry. My heart breaks hearing what you're going through. And I also want to extend so much compassion to you. Hearing how you talk about your mother, it is clear you're drawing upon an unlimited source of love for her. And that's what I think must be giving you the strength to care for her and the rest of your family members right now. I also, you know, when I was listening to your story, was thinking about anticipatory grief and how much courage it requires, because there's no way to go through that process without pain. And as somebody who has lost a parent and worked with many others who have loved somebody who received a terminal diagnosis or had an illness for which there's no known cure, we all seek that solution to pain. We want to know what will make this bearable, what will make this survivable. But I don't know what Buddhism would say, except, you know, allowing yourself to lean into that painful process is where you find great compassion and love and all of those unlimited abodes that we're. So to you being an example of those virtues.
Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, anticipatory grief, that's, yes. And also Brian said, you know, love in the face of loss, all of these things that, you know, I can kind of know intellectually. Right, but I'm trying to like understand how it feels, how they will feel. don't know if we can, but anyway. Denny, you were, I think you were next.
Tell her she's on mute.
You're on mute. Sorry.
I'm sorry about that. I have to confess, first of all, that I relate to so many of the things you said from personal experience. My mother's 92, and she's beginning to go deeper and deeper into dementia. And I actually went through a real difficult, kind of profound period before this happened of trying to deal with a lot of anger toward my mother that had accumulated over decades. I ended up being able to study her as a person and not just my mother, and go through her history and to try to empathize as deeply as I could. And that helped me so much with compassion and forgiveness. The other thing I did was study my own feelings about my own death. I'm right now in hospice training. And those two things have helped me so much to deal with the inevitability. It's an inevitability for all of us, but it's imminent, I think, for my mother. And to be able to engage with her, it's just the most wonderful feeling for me. It's a real conundrum. I can feel the love and the compassion, but I also am also beginning to feel the grief, the profound grief. And I'm thinking about both you. I'm a person who has typically been in my head too. And I'm thinking about your mother. Goodness gracious, as a psychiatric nurse, she has taken on the most profound pain, I'm sure, from a whole lot of people, but probably has never felt like she could release much of that. And I'm guessing from experience that that's part of the nastiness that you're seeing from her. And that's going to be difficult, but maybe if you can kind of empathize and understand where that might be coming from, that would be helpful. I could sit over a cup of coffee and chat with you for an hour about this, but I guess that's all I can say now without starting to wander too far. And use up too much time. But I also feel immense compassion for you both, or for your whole family, but particularly you and your mother. So
thank you.
I wish you well.
Thank you. You're doing that work of like being friends with death, you know. We had this death and dying group here. We were working on some things last year. We're kind of dormant right now in terms of that, I guess. But I'm interested in that. I had cancer myself, and so that kind of, you know, was a step in that direction, I guess, of
acknowledging. I did too.
Oh yeah.
I did. I had breast cancer too.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we do need to have some coffee. Mm-hmm. But it's like the work of all of that is so important, but it gets buried by daily concerns. And I have to remember, I think caregivers need to remember to stop and do what they have to do for themselves. And also, I'm very prone to psychosomatic stuff. Like everything gives me a headache and makes me feel off. So especially this period of time, I have to be very kind of aware of how it's doing. Thank you. Jinryu, are you next over there in the dirt? I don't think I can hear the dirt. Are you speaking?
So Paulette had her hand raised before I did. So Paulette, do you want to go ahead?
Oh, thanks, Jinryu. I just wanted to say thank you, Ellen, for your candor and your vulnerability. I think this topic is tough. I'm also dealing with a mother who has dementia, so I feel for you, and thank you for your talk.
Thank you. Thanks, Paulette. Jinryu.
So can they hear me now?
Yeah.
So I was going to add just a couple of things that you made me think of. And first of all, how much I appreciated your story and how open you were about it. I come from a tradition where I have become very accustomed to recognizing when I have done something wrong, studying what I have done wrong, talking to another person about what I have done wrong, and then with that person's or that group's support, going to whomever I wronged and making an apology. And then you stop there, you let it go. Your apology is sincere. This is what I did. I'm really sorry I did that. And that's it. So, and the outcome is left to the universe. Whatever happens is whatever happens. My job is to take care of myself and keep my part of the street clean. And I don't know if that helps you in terms of you're saying things that did not go well in the past and things you feel you responsible for in some way. I'm not using your words, I'm using mine, but that's what I thought about and what I offer in case that is helpful. Another thing is that I stood in front of Norman Fisher at a retreat with about 100 people around me, maybe more. And it was that ceremony where each person goes up and asks a question. And by the time I got up there, I just blurted out this question, but it was, I have people in my life whom I can't forgive. And it was really pretty much eating me up. I did not come from the kind of family that you did. And he said, who says you have to forgive them? And I was free. And I have been free ever since. And I am a big believer now in that I'm just not too worried much about forgiveness. Again, if I'm keeping my side of the street clean, if I am living right, if I am making the right effort, if I am being loving and kind, if I am being respectful, what else is there? What difference does it make whether I say I forgive you or not? I can tell you, it makes no difference to the people that I have in my head right now. It makes no difference to them. And then the last thing I thought about, and I think this has been alluded to by others, I did not have to play a long-term caregiving role to either of my parents, but I do remember as they got older, and there was no dementia there, but it was simply, they got older and began to act differently. And things they never said they would do, they began to do. And, you know, I would try, and I was not living in their town, I was living reasonably far away, and I would try and be there with them at certain points in time to do this. I need to get mom's glasses fixed. I need to check her wardrobe and make sure she's got the right clothes for this, that, or the other thing. All these things that I wanted to do for her. And she wouldn't want to do anything once I was there. She just wanted to sit and talk to me. And I would get angry. And that was the thing that I wanted to share with you, is that despite the love that we have and the desire to be kind and compassionate, I got angry. I got angry quite a bit, and I had to deal with that. And that's, again, an area of where one has to take care of oneself. Just to hold up a mirror for a moment, I heard a lot about what you want to do and about the love that you want to offer and the compassion that you want to muster and offer to your family. It would be interesting to see what your sister has to say about all that. Because you're not the only one in this. There's probably a lot more, but I just really enjoyed your talk, and please call anytime if you want to visit more.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Jim. My sister and I could not be more different in temperament. She is more like my mom, and she is edgy and will fly off the handle, like in good ways and bad. Like, she's likely to get up on a chair and sing and dance, you know what I mean, in the middle of a restaurant. So I'm very different. My mom's energy is very different from mine, my sister's energy. So that's why it's challenging. Always has been. It's a little bit exhausting for me. But when it comes to what you were saying about forgiveness, like, I keep thinking that I don't really feel like I have anyone to forgive. I don't feel like I've been wronged in many ways. Maybe there's an ex-husband there, but, you know. But, I mean, I feel it's mostly me that I need to forgive, and that's important to moving on in this stage. So I don't know. That's kind of the inverse of what you're saying, but how am I going to be okay with all of this if I can't get past myself? Well, here we are, quarter after the hour. Thank you all so much for listening. I'll do the dedication. We offer the merit of the Sangha meeting to all, so they may be able to attain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone. Yes. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.